SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back, and I apologize there to Bo. We've got storms here, and we lost power. Well, power went out, and that's where we went. And Bo's on his way to the sales ground, and we appreciate it. Always fun to check in with Bo. And if you aren't familiar, BoLaneBloodstock.com. To get a hold of Bo, and he's raised so many nice horses, including the likes of, obviously, Carpe Diem, but Trinidad was his, and he's had, in fact, I was going to ask him about Blippin' the Buy, which is a horse that he campaigned, stakes, graded stake placed, that Al Stahl trained, and Tappet's Fly came out of Bo, and Feral. Another of the Woodline products does a tremendous job and has got a tremendous eye and breeds a nice horse as well. Now, if you were unfamiliar with Bo, now you'll see his name on the breeding line, Bo Lane the Third, and you put yourself in good stead if you're looking for a place to board your mares and have your babies raised well. Reach out to Bo. BoLaneBloodstock.com. It's a pleasure to. It's interesting. FedBiz had one. He's obviously bullish. And FedBiz, I think, stands for small money, I think, for 10. And he had only one yesterday, a filly that Millridge consigned, $250,000, hip 48 yesterday. And this happened to be a sister to Money Multiplier and the ill-fated Intense Holiday. Ugh, so sad. Intense Holiday. That was the nice Starlight that got sick and it went wrong. That was so bad. Not fair. $250 for this out of an unbridled song mare. Intensify was her name. And family of goes back. Look at the female family. Crafty Shaw. Chocolate One. Wow, sister, second dam, sister to Chocolate One. And Mr. Chocolate and Chocolate Man, the nice family. So, $250 for a $10,000 stud fee. I appreciate Bo Lane's visit and Brian D. Donato. Hour two upon us, and happy to get the first visit. You heard from Pat Cummings as his session with the Hong Kong Jockey Club was reaching the end. He hinted at something new and exciting and different. And then he let us know what it was, that he was going to join in with Craig Burnick and the initiative of the Thoroughbred Idea Foundation, think tank concept, racing ideas on Twitter. It's provoked lots of great conversation already, and the first formal presentation and the first formal conversation starter in the form of a white paper about breakage. And this has been a topic that through the winter and spring got a lot of attention, and we had fun conversation both on radio and TV with Marshall Graham, and Marshall contributed to the paper, we welcome Pat Cummings to talk about everything going on at the Thoroughbred Idea Foundation, and specifically this breakage piece that really, I think, for those that didn't understand it or weren't aware of it, Pat, a very productive way to introduce the foundation to the stake-holding public and the horse player base and really everybody around and interested in the game. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve, and nice to speak with you without such a phone delay as we engaged back in Hong Kong. And thanks for the kind words. It was, as you said, it is just the first. It was a kind of a topic of some low-hanging fruit, but, it's still ongoing. We did a significant amount of research on the topic, and realistically, nothing has been done. No advances, so to speak, have been accomplished on kind of solving the issue of breakage and for basically 25 years. And it was Steve Crist who, back in 1994, was on, at the time, Governor Mario Cuomo's commission to examine racing and to find ways to improve the sport. And New York is the only jurisdiction on the continent to have made any changes to breakage in basically history in North America and with tote wagering. They're the only state to have ever done anything. And what they did was to reduce breakage from a dime to a nickel for every dollar on payouts of $10 or less. And this weekend, we put the tweet up at Racing Ideas. Just on Saturday alone, NYRA generated $18,000 in breakage in the win pool. And off, I think it was about $2.5 million in the win pool on Saturday. Whereas Gulfstream, which has dime breakage for all payments, generated almost the same amount of money in breakage on just over $1 million in the win pools. And it really shows that, New York is really one of the best plays and really is looking out for the player from a breakage standpoint when it comes to it. It was really a fascinating topic to dive into because, again, so few people have really tried to tackle it, and we are trying. And putting it out, one of the things we realized is there are so many people, industry stakeholders, young and old, who are fairly benign to the practice even occurring. It's just one of those things that we've heard from horse players. But the average, racing person on the street is generally unaware of it. And that's one of the things that we are trying to do is to raise the awareness on topics such as these and hopefully then advocate for change once we're educating.
We'll flesh some of the breakage conversation out, and people have heard this discussion any number of times here, whether it was Marshall's initiative during the Triple Crown season. After each Triple Crown race, he used the winner, used Justify as an example of what could be returned to players. Before we get into it and lay out some of the direct benefits as well as some of the unintended consequence benefits that people might not think of, that the paper did a nice job fleshing out. We'll get to that. Let's talk and get everybody familiar, Pat, with the foundation concept, what you and what Craig and what the members of the board and what you're hoping to achieve and what the what the progress is so far. It's only been a few months, but give everybody the overview of what motivated this, your interest in committing to it, and how you hope and how we all can benefit industry wide from a think tank style approach.
Well, the start was really with Craig, obviously, and Craig Byrne at Glen Hill Farm. And Craig has certainly committed himself to the industry and taking over the interest of Glen Hill from his grandfather, Leonard Lavin, and has been, you know, as Craig would say it, and I've heard him say it enough times to paraphrase him, he sat on many different boards. He's been on the Breeders' Cup board. He's across the industry. And just felt as though there wasn't enough being accomplished and being discussed to actually affect meaningful change. And I would suggest that, you know, Craig's idea, which then he later came to me with, was that, you know, let's take this opportunity to educate the industry stakeholders, advocate for changes where we think they are needed, and then incubate ideas and future-looking plans for the sport, and identify where innovation is possible, and challenge conventional norms. Look, there are many organizations that have done, in general, good things for the sport. There's no question about that. But has it brought about meaningful change in the industry when it comes to, say, the metrics that we're judged by, full crops, overall betting handle? Unfortunately, when you look at the metrics, the answer is probably no. We've seen a decline in the number of races run by half over the last 30 years. We've obviously seen handle come down. The numbers are well known. Handle is essentially stagnant at the moment. It'll be interesting to see where the next couple months go. As you know, the early returns for 2018 seem positive, but I think we're just kind of catching up with the effect of the W2G changes and the IRS changes. So, you know, it feels somewhat positive this year, and if things were to continue with the current rate, it would be the best year in almost 20 years, which is certainly a good sign, but it hasn't been great over those last 20 years. And it was time to suggest that we can't keep doing the same things we've been doing and expect that the industry is simply going to improve. And Craig, fortunately, was in a position to say, well, let's put some effort behind this and some resources behind it. And then they attracted me to come back from Hong Kong to take up the cause. And we've put a fantastic board of directors together, a very diverse set of individuals from across the industry of all types. Paul Matisse, a regular guest of yours, Steve, is on the board. And we've Justin Nicholson and Donna Barton Brothers and Tom Reynolds, who's an Eclipse partner and a former, you know, senior VP at Pepsi, you know, all alongside Leslie Howard from Stone Street, and just a great group. Jack Wolf of Starlights with us, Rory Babich, who is an advisor with St. Elias and former CEO of the Florida Panthers. It's a fantastic group, and all of these people, I didn't name them all, but they're all committed to the sport. And they have been for a long time, and we're trying to challenge the sport as a whole to seek improvement. And so part of that, I'd say, half of the mission is educating and advocating, whereas the other half then is incubating and bringing ideas along. Our idea on penny breakage is not about incubating; it's about educating and advocating. So that's kind of the first thing that we put out. But we're certainly looking to work with industry innovators, identify new ways to do things in the sport. And to be honest, Steve, having been in Hong Kong, I said it was about 3 years. It was like getting a PhD in horse racing administration. It was a fantastic experience. But this really excited me tremendously to come home and to work on American racing from a really different angle. And I'm excited for the future, incredibly optimistic about what I think we'll be able to achieve. But we've had plenty of questions of people saying, well, what are you going to do about breakage? It's great that you put it out there. Well, we needed to put it out there. But the next steps will come advocating with different jurisdictions to try to bring about change. And a lot of that's going to happen behind the scenes, and some of it's already underway.
And in generic terms, using the withholding success and you know, the NTRA worked for more than a decade, on getting that change accomplished. And it took a shift in the focus and the approach to push the peanut, one of my favorite expressions in efforts like this. And so a lot of this is the kind of thing that, you know, depending on the effort and the concept, are long-term, can be long-term plays. The themes of advocacy and trying to institute change, and in some cases, Pat, you're talking about seismic shifts in mentality and in corporate culture, and, you know, in things that are, you know, real legitimate challenges. What kind of either broad strokes or specific initiative and I would say focused efforts, give everybody a glance at how you think the consensus can be reached on topics, or as we'll merge into the breakage conversation specifically, how there can be the start of some change, because the breakage project feels like something that could be a domino, and much like the way active steroid use on circuits was eliminated, you know, once one area of the country, the Mid-Atlantic, for instance, once they started and ruled off the use of steroids, that, you know, prompted a very rapid, a shockingly rapid agreement throughout all the jurisdictions to eliminate the steroids from the landscape. What are your thoughts about how different initiatives can be successfully implemented?
The snowball down the hill effect is one we're definitely pursuing, Stephen, and thinking that it will, you know, particularly on this topic, can gain momentum and growth. But it all has to start with a small snowball at the top of the hill and getting the right push down. It's funny, in the research we uncovered that, you know, in some of Steve Criss' writings about the takeout from breakage or what they were able to do in 1994, he really thought that the sport was going to be a tipping point and that other people were going to change. And it didn't happen. If we were to eliminate the current system of breakage and move to a penny breakage system, it does tip a lot of other elements and makes a lot of other things possible that currently aren't. The elimination of minus pools, the elimination of mandatory minimum payouts, getting rid of the 210s, paying down the 202, for example. But it also opens up the opportunity to modernize the tote and to institute, say, the FlexiBet payment system, whereas instead of sitting there and figuring out a pick six payment where you you want to put in a $256 ticket, you're no longer bound by the number of combinations and having paid for that. You can simply say, I want this combination, I want it for $100, and you get a percentage of the play. Well, penny breakage can help lead to that modernization and help affect some change there. But to kind of go back to the original point, Steve, and having to use the breakage as kind of the example, I was at the Saratoga Law Conference that Bennett Liebman put on with Albany and spoke on this topic of breakage on a panel talking about the future of wagering in New York State. And Gary Pretlow, the assemblyman who chairs the one of the major state committees on gaming, was on the committee, and I kind of gave a bit of a 10-minute intro on the topic. And when it came around to the assemblyman, You know, he basically said, I don't think the average person really cares about breakage. And, you know, later admitted that, you know, it helps purses, et cetera, et cetera. But a look at the numbers and the logic behind it just suggests otherwise, particularly in some jurisdictions like New York. And when we just wrote 4,500 words on breakage in this white paper, and we're trying to put the case together in a very logical, straightforward fashion, which really hasn't been done before. It hasn't been done in such a format, Steve, okay? There are plenty of great things. We've got some amazing quotes from not just Steve, Chris, from years ago, but even going back as far as 1940 when the Pulitzer Prize journalist. Yeah, it was a fantastic line from Herbert Baird Swope, who at the time was the head of the New York Commission, saying that this is just a wrong practice. But when you actually step back and kind of take that 10,000-foot view of the topic, there's very few people that could look at it and say, gosh, you know, I need to fight this. We need to keep this the way it is. There's very few people that are going to say that. And New York is a fantastic example of this, where when we looked at it, the total amount of breakage that NYRA retains on an annual basis last year, this is in the publicly available reports online, was about $3 million. But NYRA's taxed on breakage, so the after-tax amount comes out to about $1.9 million. Yet NYRA paid $1.8 million in minus pools last year. So they only ended up netting 3% of the originally retained breakage. So to suggest, somewhat anecdotally, that the racetracks are benefiting is not a universal case whatsoever. And in fact, there were two standard bred tracks in New York. There were two different tracks, for what it's worth, in each of the last 2 years, who paid out more in minus pools than they took in breakage. So this may be longstanding belief that the racetracks are never going to support this. You can't say that's the case in New York, because these states are paying out, in some cases, more money than they're taking in this leftover change. And it does add up over time, but the benefit might not be as great as it once was. So by challenging the conventional norms and putting the numbers in kind of the clear data in a concise fashion out there, we think that if the some of the industry stakeholders really did take a look at this, that they would agree the same, that there is a reason and a cause for change. Now, unfortunately, it's very obvious to us that it would be very difficult to sit there and prove without an unarguable degree that without question, putting this money back in the hands of bettors will absolutely yield, say, $200 million in additional wagers. You're never going to be able to directly prove that. But you are going to have to take the chance. And every now and then, horse racing is going to have to play let's make a deal. And eventually, someone's going to have to go for what's inside the box or what's behind the door, as opposed to taking the deal that they've been taking for a long, long time, because that's what they know and understand. And hopefully more often than not, you'd be a winner as opposed to ending up with a couple pigs in a cage, which occasionally happens. But, you know, we think it's high time to start making some changes.
Let's give everybody, and I know that some of you, most of you probably have heard this exercise, and if you haven't read through the paper, there are charts that lay out the dollars and cents, but in a quick synopsis and a simple synopsis, Pat, give everybody a feel, and Marshall Graham did this, you know, after each Triple Crown race, give everybody a feel about the breakage dollars and cents, and then we'll talk about some of those side benefits that could come out of this, and we'll also explain, you know, what the trickle down effect is. And very much like you heard for 10 years talking about the withholding and how the churn, and this was always the challenge that the NTRA faced, Peggy Hendershot in particular, explaining to congressmen that your tax revenue will be even greater if you lower this threshold, because there'll be more money bet, and the net effect, and the storyline is the same here, and we'll flesh that out, but explain the pennies and what the mechanics are, Pat, so we can then, you know, take it to the next step and talk about, you know, some of the other benefits and some of the ways in which I think industry participants could get this started to their own benefit, you know, quite quickly and painlessly.
Well, we also consulted with Maury Wolf, Steve, the racing economist and better, who I know has been on the show in the past and put in some fantastic input. And one of the things that Maury said to us was, you know, you need to explain to the average person where breakage exists in their normal life and make a comparison. And it was a great addition for Maury to the overall paper. And it's fairly straightforward. Paying for a tank of gas, paying for produce, anything you pay for weight, those scales typically round to, you know, the thousandths decimal, and you basically pay to the nearest penny. So that's the way that life works outside of racing. But from the betting standpoint, it doesn't. And the great example really is Justify, and as you said, Marshall's talked about this before, but it's very straightforward. You have the takeout rate at, say, Pimlico, which is 18% on the win line. So 18% of the pool comes out off the top. And whatever's left, that leftover amount in the win pool, a very simple calculation takes place that you divide the total win pool by the amount of money that is bet on Justify, in this case, to win. And that leftover number becomes the base return for $1. Well, in the Preakness this year, that number was $1.44. Okay, I'm rounding to the nearest penny there. So for a $2 return, that would be $2.88. But Justify only paid $2.80. Pimlico, state of Maryland, rounds down to the nearest dime. So if this was in New York and Justify would have paid $1.46, it would have been rounded to $1.45 and would have returned $2.90. At Pimlico, at $1.44, for example, it would also round down to $1.40. So you multiply it by two, you get $2.80. So what happens to those 4 cents? Those 4 cents are held back by the bet taker. It could be the racetrack. It could be an OTB. It can be an ADW. The ADWs get to keep all that money themselves. Okay, there is no law that suggests that the ADWs have to pay that out. So they maintain that themselves. Whereas if you were to bet on track, the racetrack retains those leftover 4 pennies and has to do something with it as laid out by some state regulation. In New York, the money is split between the track and the state, for example. Well, that money adds up. Okay, so for every $2 bet on Justify, there was 8 cents of breakage. Total breakage for the race ended up totaling $355,000. And in the three different win pools across the entire Triple Crown, it was more than $1 million in win pool breakage that was retained. Okay, just using Pimlico as the example, with that total amount that is retained, like I said, $355,000. If you add that in, add back the takeout that's already been retained, and figure out what percentage of the pool that is in total, your win takeout's gone from an 18% actual takeout to an effective takeout of almost 21%. It was 20.69%. So for all the discussions that are had about takeout and finding the optimal rate, no one's rarely ever going to see that amount taken out. It's always going to be a little bit more as long as breakage still exists. And in some cases, it can really be pushing 21% on the win, place, and show pools. It's a substantial amount, and when you add it all up, it comes out to about 0.45% of total handle of what we estimate to be about $50 million a year that is held back. Put that money back in the hands of the bettors and let them churn it through. If you were to churn $50 million 8 times at a 20% blended takeout, it's $208 million. And there's essentially nothing to say that that doesn't continue, that that trickle doesn't keep happening through every iteration. So it's significant.
That number, and this very much like the equation involved in the withholding, if that money goes back into the hands of players, you can anticipate how much of the churn is, and that's where you're getting the $200 million potential impact, which would be a 2%, you know, national handle bump.
Which it's not gone up by that percentage. I think the highest we've seen in the last 15 years is about 1.7% as an increase. So yes, but based on the current history, if we were to see a $200 million handle increase, that'd be the largest single percentage increase in that last 15, 17 years or so. It's really significant. And you know what else it would do, Steve? It would make place and show betting interesting once again. Okay, the lower the payouts, the higher the percentage of breakage as a representation of the profit. You know, you hit a $50 exacta and maybe you see 9 cents in breakage. It's a lot different than if you're betting a horse that returns, you know, 280 to show, but it would have been 288. You know, there's this big difference as a percentage. And, you know, place and show in those particular pools, particularly with some more newer players, casual players, it's essentially a regressive tax on the casual player. The professionals are not, you know, wading into the place in the show pools. And this would make those pools a little bit more competitive again. And there's a great quote from Steve Crist in the piece that says, you know, imagine if you turned up at the racetrack one day and instead of getting 960, 420, and 260, you got 978, 431, and 276. That adds up over time. The value is there. And the other thing that, you know, this would recognize, Steve, is that the sport has changed. It's changed dramatically in the last 25 years, even to, you know, it's a much different game and a wagering entity than it was even when Steve Crist last brought about the last meaningful change in breakage. With the shift to ADWs, with the use of cash vouchers and automated betting machines, all of the rationale that was used for breakage back in the 1930s, which was we need breakage because it will help speed up all of the processes to pay out customers, that's all gone. Okay, we're not concerned about long tote lines anymore at the windows. It's just not. It's not a modern concern for the sport when the majority of the action is happening in basically a cashless world. And, you know, the reasons and the rationale have all changed. And but the sport itself hasn't modernized its regulations to reflect that. And that was one of the things we really wanted to challenge, that if we're going to go forward, if we are going to modernize the sport and the tote and wagering, particularly in light of an environment that is much friendlier to low takeout, fixed odds wagering that's certainly coming in a legal fashion, racing needs to be more competitive, and this is one way it can do so.
Let's hit on the outlets and how it potentially could be received and be affected. Have you had conversations with tote division management on the racetrack side?
Some. I can tell you this, from an ADW side, we did speak with one ADW, and obviously ADWs are really the biggest benefactors of breakage at this point. That they retain all of it. They don't have to pay it out as the racetracks do. But one IT director for an ADW did speak with us and said straightforward that there is, there are many issues technologically that hold up tote modernization in America, okay, that racetracks have to pay to really enhance, and not just racetracks, but the industry as a whole needs to pay for some real tote modernization. And this person said to us, this is one thing that basically requires no new development.
Right.
There aren't many things that you can say that to when it comes to modernizing, but this is one thing that is it's basically just a number in an equation that gets factored in, and it would basically require zero development. And I found that to be very encouraging, especially that an ADW would say to us straight up that, look, this could be changed tomorrow, and, on a tech side. So when you say that there's essentially a no-cost alternative to changing this, that it would require very little startup cost to make the change, at least we know that that's an encouraging side benefit of making this change. Now, getting it to happen, like anything else, Steve, is still a 37-state process. And that is essentially what we think is going to be a holdup. Now, if there was a state out there, Steve, that took advantage of it and wanted to get that first mover status, and there can only be one of them, okay, one state making the change would give them some sort of an early mover advantage. We threw out an example of New Mexico in the paper, where half of New Mexico breakage, so on-track breakage in New Mexico, half of it goes to the state bred program in New Mexico. Well, we live in a world where purse money should be increasing, okay? It should not be going down. If you want to reduce the number of races, that's fine, but horsemen cannot get by with lower purses. Well, breakage in New Mexico racetracks declined by 31% over a three-year period, from 2014 to 2016. Well, guess what else has gone down? Purses in New Mexico bred races. As more money continues to shift to the ADWs in the current landscape of how breakage is calculated, that's all, the racetracks and these other programs which have at one point in time benefited from breakage, that's not going to continue. That will continue to decline slowly over time as the current environment, the current regulations exist. So if a state wants to get out in front of this and make the change, imagine if in January when Sunland opens, Sunland suddenly starts paying, an even money shot is suddenly returning maybe 8 or 9% more because there's no breakage. That makes betting Sunland very attractive, particularly to the professional. And we think that if one or two states were to start that process, that it would kick in and some others would follow suit.
Well, on a much simpler front, not simpler, but on a parallel track, why wouldn't one of the ADW companies use this as a competitive advantage from a marketing standpoint and just start paying their users the breakage amount?
Yeah.
It'd be a huge competitive, a mammoth advantage, and the rest would follow suit very quickly.
I actually had followed suit is an interesting term to use, Steve. I actually had a conversation with someone who had indicated that they wondered if the ADWs were essentially engaging in unfair practices by continuing to hold it back. collectively. I said, well, hey, you pursue that on your own. But yes, why would someone not want to be a part of that and take that advantage? And if you do that, I think the dominoes would start falling. Like you said early on in the conversation, there are lots of opportunities for this to get moving. And at some point, it's just about the way we look at the sport and the way we look at the business and operation of racing. Continuing to do things the way we've always done is just not tenable for the future, particularly in the increasing competitive environment in which we live in, for the wagering dollar. And it's these types of things that we are challenging and hope to continue to do so over time.
Within the stakeholder community, undoubtedly you've had some initial discussions, Pat, and I'm sure Craig has as well. And everybody has certain network of relationships. Where have you met with a positive reception and areas within the industry that are eager to participate and help some of these kinds of initiatives take root?
Well, I can say that just on the breakage topic, as soon as we launched the report, we had a couple people reach out to us in some fairly high-ranking positions within the sport who, at the state levels, who saw it and said, this is really quite compelling, and I'd like to maybe try and take this to our regulators. So I don't want to give it away just yet because it's a long process and it's starting, but let's just say that we've had some incredibly productive introductory conversations with what I would call some high-placed individuals within the sport who are well taken by the chance that changing the approach to breakage could have. Now, this is going to apply, hopefully, on many different elements. Nothing should be off the table when it comes to helping racing, Steve. The numbers simply can't afford it. The sport is not priced properly. Information is not as transparently available. There are things that we can do and change and adjust. And I just don't think the sport is in the position to say, no, sorry, can't do that, can't do this. Particularly if such a solution is not incredibly expensive. I was just looking at numbers in Pennsylvania, of course, my home state, and I had done a lot of research back in the day, but I saw the numbers more recently that the total amount of revenue, say, that Parks has received from wagering in the last 5 years is down 37%. These are catastrophic declines. And while a state like Pennsylvania, roughly 88 or 90% of prize money is coming from the slot machine subsidies, at some point, if you're not paying attention to the basic core business principles to attract people to play your races and to participate, then you have to think at some point the state is going to look at this and say, you guys aren't doing enough for your own sport. You're not making enough changes. You're not staying competitive and remaining competitive. And these are the types of things that we need to gain that competitiveness back. And this is just one of those small little things. So the conversations are being had, and I'm hopeful that what we did and how we've started talking about this can bring about that change. And those early criticisms of this is great to talk about it, but what are we going to do? It's underway. It is underway.
To get to the unintended positive implications of the breakage question, one of the things that you touched on and we didn't explain it fully is how things like bridge jumping could be rendered moot as a benefit. And you know, the whole concept, and you touched on it as well, about the, you know, about the negative pool payouts, it would basically go away. And you know, that the, you know, those kinds of sidebar benefits are part of this too, that you know, wouldn't necessarily be apparent, you know, right off the, you know, right off the bell, but you know, would actually have you know, a positive effect, and actually is probably a selling point to the racetracks for anybody that doesn't understand what the churn, you know, that doesn't immediately grasp the benefits of the churn. And I mean, it's one thing explaining it to congressmen; it's a little bit different. You know, racetrack management understands the, you would hope, understands the churn discussion.
Yeah, a switch to paying to the penny would have to coincide with eliminating that mandatory minimum return, which in most jurisdictions now is $2.10. There's a few still out there, I think, that are $2.20. Of course, the bet takers have to make up the difference in the concept of bridge jumping. That if a huge amount is placed to wager, so such that it has the amount that has to be paid back to meet that minimum exceeds the total amount of money in the pool, then the track has to foot the bill for that, or the bet taker has to foot the bill. Well, that amount can add up. It can be significant. But the quotes from Steve Crist that we put in here are some of the absolute most salient logic on the topic. And he says, this is from the racing form back in 2014, there's absolutely no logic to having an artificial guaranteed minimum, which in fact violates the whole point of the parimutuel system and the neutrality of the stakeholder. Now, I personally love to bet against the bridge jumpers at every opportunity I see. It's always kind of a, you know rooting against them. But he goes on to say some players may lament the absence of the occasional opportunity to play against a bridge jump horse. But this is where we have to look at the long-term math. All those players will do far better in the long run getting the payoffs they deserve on every race. And if you eliminate that mandatory minimum requirement, you pay out to the actual penny, the minimum would essentially drop to $2.02 with a penny of breakage on every dollar. And it does take away the bridge jumping. It does, but the bet takers would be benefited by that. And it's one of those things where, you know, I had some very good conversations with some folks at NYRA who say, look, we get taxed on our breakage, and we have to pay out all of the minus pools. So even though you allow us, meaning the state allows NYRA to hold back breakage, they tax them on it, and then, you know, are required to meet this mandatory minimum and make the payout. And as the numbers reflected from 2017, it's basically a wash. And so whatever those long-term benefits that people may have thought they were getting, at least on the racetrack side, they're really not. Meanwhile, ADWs have developed and grew up in a environment where they didn't have to deal with breakage in the same capacity, and they operate unencumbered. It surely is a benefit to them. There's no question about that. And Paul Matisse, of course, on our board, was very keen to note that breakage is built into the business model of many of these ADWs. So they do rely on that income. It probably helps in some of the rebating. Rebates would probably have to change if ADWs were no longer able to retain breakage. These are all consequences that we understand would trickle down from a change to penny breakage. There are some states also, I think Florida is one in particular, where the prize money is not enhanced by slot revenue. And while the racetracks can have some sort of alternate gaming, the slots don't directly impact the purses. And there are places in Florida, I think Tampa is one of them, where, you know, breakage is a component of paying back to the purses. Now, is it a huge component? Absolutely not. It's very small. But it's about looking at the pie a little bit differently. We're trying to grow the pie. We don't want to just take money from X and give it to Y and say, have a nice day. This is about growing the pie for X and Y together, which we believe is something that would happen if you were to change these policies and let the horse player do their thing, give them the full return that they've long deserved. And we think it would be best for the sport. And, you know, that you're going to churn no matter what. The exact number is still in question, but we think it would make up for the difference that breakage currently represents.
Well, and these types of initiatives, what the NTRA accomplished, and there's you know, some other smaller, not as apparent, small victories. All of these kinds of efforts help, I think, not just putting the money in people's pockets, where it just makes it more fair, and it's just the right thing to do. It shows that the industry, I mean, the people that want to get behind this, it sends a positive message to the horse playing community that they're appreciated and that they're an integral part. I mean, the biggest frustration is that for a lot of players is that they look and they don't see whether it's marketing presence or an ongoing attempt to reward and to acknowledge the existing customer base. I'm a little tired of the constant drum beating and flag waving to go find skinny jeans wearing, millennials. Let's take care of our core business, please, and the customers that have been stoking the coal car for decades on end. And it's great to go, pretend that we're bringing in all these new young horse players. And yes, we have to introduce the game to people as early as possible. So in the development curve, they're in the pipeline. You have to cultivate that business. That's fine. But let's address the core customer and maintain and win their appreciation and loyalty, and let them be acknowledged. And this is one of those very small and seemingly easy victories that would go a long way in that direction.
There's no reason that both can't be done, Steve. And the difference being that once you recruit that younger, the skinny jeans wearing fan, which is certainly not me, once you recruit that person, and if they start learning about how the sport is priced in its current situation, it's a turnoff. So we would be accomplishing a couple things with our existing customers by pricing the sport as it really should have been for a long time and looking after them. But you have to think that your potential future customer is more aware, more price sensitive, more in tune with how wagering is, the cost of wagering is factored into, no matter whether it's racing or sports or casinos or poker, than ever before. The newer customer is going to be more and more informed than ever before. So if you don't treat as much as you want those customers, if they find out how the sport is priced in its current format, it's a huge turnoff. So So there are so many benefits to starting to price racing in a much different fashion. There's no argument, and we say this in the paper. Racing is a very intensive sport. It has a tremendous amount of land use. It takes up a lot of space. There's a huge economy that's behind it. Lots of people, in the system that are required to put on the show. It is an expensive sport to maintain. It's never going to be priced like a sports bet with a roughly 5% takeout. I understand that. And I don't think anybody should be suggesting otherwise. The racing has expenses. But there's what is the ideal price for the sport versus what we're doing right now are two very different things. And even new customers are going to be more and more sensitive to pricing as time goes by.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is, this helps offset some other, and I'm sure we'll have more conversations of this, of this ilk, as you go forward. How can people help? Is there a way? We had the letter writing campaigns, obviously, that and during the comment period when it came to the withholding and the Treasury Department addressing those issues, that really the horse playing community really came through. How do the players and how do how do people contribute to this, Pat? How does TIF want people to chip in?
By all means, if individuals do reach out to their state regulators and their state commissions, it would be a huge benefit. Unfortunately, unlike the NTRA's tremendous job with what they were able to do, this still remains a state issue as opposed to a federal one. And while they were able to direct all of the resources into one particular area with the IRS, that unfortunately is not the case on this topic. So it does remain divided amongst the states. So it's going to have to be a person-to-person campaign. And while we are certainly reaching out to what we think might be some ripe jurisdictions that potentially could help effect some change, any person in racing who is able to reach out to anyone of influence within their sphere, within their state, please do so. It seems like small change breakage, but it really does add up over time, and it's just the logical thing to do, particularly in this day and age and competitive marketplace. So for horse players, for racing fans alike, please reach out within your state and work to affect change as much as we'll be trying to do the same within our group and our board and with regulators nationwide.
Some preview toward some other ideas and areas that you hope to address in coming months and years?
Yeah, we've got a lot in the fire, Steve. One of the things that we are working on is trying to help explain to racing fans. This is another kind of point of simple education that we think can go a long way to help understand where the industry is how purses are really funded. Where does the money come from? What are the inputs? Because as many have said, I know Maury Wolf has said this to you over the years as well, handle up does not necessarily mean purses up. Not all handle is the same, and so we really do want to help explain to the industry, which will involve horsemen and horse players and racing fans alike. Let's understand how our sport is priced, because at the end of the day, it's the owners investing in horses and running in races, and the bettors who are going to be very valuable to understand. These are your financial inputs to the sport, and we want to do that. We want to work on, some elements that tie to transparency of information. And one of the areas that remains increasingly opaque is morning workouts. And we have a couple ideas, and this would be more truly on the kind of the idea factory side of the business, of what could be done to illuminate what goes on in the morning at racetracks. And we think there are some trickle-down effects that can help the industry in a variety of ways. But by illuminating what happens in the morning, taking some of the mystique away from that and shedding some light where it's currently pretty dark, we think it could have some meaningful long-term benefits. So more on that to come. We're working with some industry stakeholders on that to try and get people on board in advance even of what we put out. So stay tuned.
Well, where can everybody follow? And for those that haven't seen the paper yet, give them directions, Pat, to catch up on everything we discussed.
We have racingthinktank.com, and it's really just a starter site that's up there now. There's a more professional one in the works, and we'll be getting that up in a short period of time. And the paper is there right now. It's just online, but we'll have a PDF version up eventually. We have an executive summary, too, that will go with it. So we're just getting off the ground, Steve, but it's a good start. I've been on board for probably about 6 weeks or so, so it's been a lot of fun. And you know, anyone with any ideas, pun intended, reach out. We'll be happy to engage. And you can also email us at thoroughbredideafoundation@gmail.com, and or reach out on Twitter either to me personally or at Racing Ideas, and we'd love to hear from people.
Pat Cummings, everybody, and always fun. And for those of you that are curious, when does Hong Kong Conversation start? Thursday. Andrew Hawkins joins us on Thursday, and been a couple of meetings already, and tomorrow actually as well. Happy Valley, and looking forward to getting going with Andrew on Thursday. Pat, I appreciate this, and I hope everybody understands what the benefits are here and what could be accomplished. And as I have said for years, using one of the great LBJ quotes, don't spit in the soup, we've all got to eat it. And this is one of those areas we've all got to pull in the same direction. It's a tug of war, but there's occasions when we can all pull in the same direction.
I agree, Steve, and thanks so much for your support and the time today.
Pat Cummings, everybody. Let's take a break. Top of the hour, and Dick Powell is joining us for his Tuesday visit, and we're getting close to the two big races at Presque Isle, including the Masters, which will certainly send a major player or two to the Filly and Mare Sprint. Last year, it sent you your your enormous, ridiculous exacta. Unbelievable. And the Presque Isle Mile is coming as well, just a couple of weeks left. But Dick is I'm sure listened in, and you know, Dick has been involved in any number of the kinds of conversations and industry initiatives that have dealt with an area like this, and I'd love his input too about affecting change and you know, moving what feels like mountains in some cases. But let's be honest, nobody ever thought that the withholding rules was ever going to get changed, that project would never reach the end zone. And it has, and it's been a huge win. This is another thing that it really, really will only take a couple of aggressive, you know, postured organizations to, you know, get things going. And you would really, I mean, an ADW company could get a big benefit, I would think, and a marketing edge by paying down, you know, paying down to the penny themselves. Back after this, Dick Powell, John White. We never got to John last week, so we owe John the season ending Del Mar conversation and the other things that have been going on. And John is undoubtedly organizing toward the Breeders' Cup fields as well. So John and Dick in this next hour. Stay with us.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Enjoy Daily Racing Form's best value with a multi-track PP pack. Get five full-card PPs featuring the day's best racing for only $6. Each DRF multi-track PP pack features full-card DRF pass performances for the top tracks you want to play. Handicapping articles and analysis, closer looks for key tracks, and selections by DRF handicappers. Daily packs and longer plans for all budgets are available. Download full-card PPs for five of today's top tracks. Visit DRF.com/multi-track today.
Pennsylvania's breeding program is truly the most lucrative in North America. Now, we'll pay a 50% breeder award for PA-sired, PA-bred maidens who run first, second, or third, with 25% for non-PA-sired, PA-breds. Last year, the number of mares bred rose by 15% in Pennsylvania. And unlike some other states, our Racehorse Development Fund can only be used to support Pennsylvania breeding and racing. This is Brian Sanfratello. Please visit us at PABred.com.
Your barn is successful. Your program is tried and true. However, there are a few horses that aren't responding in the way you'd like. Does this sound familiar? Well, let Biomedical Research Labs help change that. Our clinically proven products will help your equine athletes become their very best. I guarantee it. This is Joseph Vellante. To learn more, contact me at 215-501-6880 and visit brlscience.com.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
With 35 years at the forefront of sports technology, Stats provides next-generation sports content for basketball, baseball, football, soccer. And now, Stats is turning its sights to horse racing. RaceLens is the most in-depth product on the market. With innovative analytics powered by data from Equibase, it will change the way you follow horse racing. Stats RaceLens, bringing clarity to handicapping. Learn more at stats.com/racelens.